Basel III Endgame will make it harder for consumers to buy a house or a car. It'll hurt the small businesses that rely on loans to grow, and it'll reduce savings for people with money in pension funds. Regulators propose capital requirements would take a toll on families, seniors, farmers, and small businesses. Washington, scrap Basel III Endgame and start over.
So my total flying time was something like 33 hours.
Wow.
And then it took 68 hours. There was all the other sort of gaps in between.
That's Ryan Heath. He's been on a 68-hour journey to Australia, where he's been locked down in a small hotel room for 14 days.
Oh, yeah, well, that's the other trick. The first day you arrive here is day zero. So actually, it's 15 days. They lied.
My mistake. 15 days. I don't know. I also feel like this is like what journeymen did back in the day, talk about their travels on the trail and how difficult it was and the storms and the waiting and the, you know, and you know what that's like now, Ryan. It's not just a quick 18-hour flight to Australia.
Hunter S. Thompson did not have retina scanning at every turn. So, you know, I've lived.
This is Nerdcast. I'm Tara Palmieri, one of our Playbook authors. And I'm talking to my longtime friend. Can I say you're my longtime friend?
Yes, you can. Absolutely. We believe in the truth here at Politico.
Okay, so talking to my longtime friend and colleague, Ryan Heath, about the costly and chaotic future of foreign travel and how the Biden administration is racing to catch up with global vaccine diplomacy.
Absolutely. So let's dive in.
This journey started when Ryan's mom needed a double lung transplant. And understandably, he needed to be there for her.
And the reason I had to make the trip is that my mother, who is Australian like me, just had a double lung transplant. And so there was really no question. I finally had to break through the hassle of COVID and get down here. And it proved to be a 5-week long process. This was not like jumping on a plane, taking a sleeping pill, and then waking up on the other side of the world. It is still going, and it is a major, major inconvenience, and it cost a hell of a lot of money too.
To save money, Ryan gamed out his own route to Australia, involving 4 countries and 68 hours of traveling, while trying to make sure that the multiple negative COVID test results he got would be accepted by each airline and each country, and sometimes arguing his way onto planes. Oh my God, I would have been having a panic attack.
I was definitely having a panic attack.
Yeah.
If I didn't make that first flight, there was no way to catch up with my other flights in Singapore. And the flights tend to only leave every 2 days now. So
right.
you can't just be like, oh, okay, I'll fly to LAX and then I'll catch up sort of 2 hours later. No. Once one thing goes wrong in an international COVID trip now, everything goes wrong.
Nearly 30% of adults in the United States have had one shot of a vaccine. So dare we travel? And what's it like? Ryan has had his first vaccine, but it turns out nobody seems to care. It's all about the test results.
I worked really hard to get a letter from the hospital in Sydney so that I could get a vaccination in New York before I left. And that turned out to be, you know, completely irrelevant to all
of the
authorities.
But you only had one vax, that's why. You're not double-vaxxed.
No, they have no system for processing a vaccination.
They don't.
So that might have been their problem if there had been a system for processing the vaccinations, but they just, and they 100% only care about the test results. So
Okay. While
Americans are running around ahead of most of the world and successfully getting this vaccine, they're not going to be able to flash those little CDC cards that you get when you get a vaccine and say, let me in, because nearly every country in the world is not ready to do that. And that's because most of those countries are not rolling out the vaccine themselves yet.
So right now, Ryan is in Sydney, in a hotel room, alone. All I see is like white walls and it's frightening.
I am on the 21st floor of an allegedly 5-star hotel in downtown Sydney. And I say allegedly because there are military downstairs, there are security guards on my floor, and I'm not allowed to step outside the room for the next 14 days, or rather for 14 days. And I'm currently on day 6 of that. And that's part of Australia's really strict quarantine system. There's also testing involved. I can get things ordered to the room, but this is the system they've got in place, and that's how they've kept deaths under 1,000 in the entire country. And I've been watching the news for 3 days where they've been trying to hunt a single case of COVID in the state of Queensland. And there's mass horror and a lockdown of 2.5 million people because they found 7 cases of COVID across that entire state once they began the contact tracing.
Wow. And here's the thing. How many people actually live in Australia? Like, it's a huge landmass, but what's the population?
It's only 25 million. So it is right. Roughly the same as Florida, a little bit less than Texas, a little bit more than New York. So it's spread out. But, you know, in this state where they've got the lockdown happening, Queensland, only 6 people have died out of 5 million during all of COVID because they're so extreme with their measures.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning then. I want to start the odyssey in New York, in Brooklyn.
Okay, so my mom gets the call for having to herself fly to Sydney to receive the lungs that she's been waiting for years. And it's a very scary operation. It goes for 7 hours, but it was a success. And once we knew it was a success, then I knew that I had to find a way to get to Sydney. But it was very obvious to me that that was going to be complicated from the very first step. And I say that because a one-way ticket from New York to Sydney right now is $11,000. And the reason for that is that Australia has some very severe arrival caps. They don't let more than 30 people per plane and a total of 6,000 people per week into the country. And the effect of that is you can only buy a business or first class ticket into Australia, and there aren't many flights at all. And so I don't have $11,000 just to fly to Australia. So I had to find another way to do it. And I took a lot of negotiating with people in the Fiji government and then in the Singapore government. But I settled on a route where I went via Detroit, Seoul, Singapore, where I had to stay in a special bubble hotel for 32 hours. And then finally on a business class flight from Singapore to Sydney. And by doing it that way, I did it for $4,700 instead of $11,000.
If you had flown direct and coughed up $11,600, would you have had any of these problems?
No, not all of these problems, but certainly some of them. Like the testing issue still could have been an issue, even though it would have been easier to like basically get the test and not break any of the timing rules. It certainly would have happened a lot quicker, that's for sure. I also think it would have taken longer probably to get onto a flight. I think there's more competition for the flights coming back from the US. And so my point there is that even a year into the pandemic, there's still 36,000 Australians who are stranded overseas because they can't afford the ticket to get back. And so they constantly try and buy the ticket they can afford and see if there's a slot on the aircraft. And usually they get bumped and it's not possible. So I think, yes, if you just paid the $11,000, you can buy your way out. But even then, sometimes there's probably 31 people who are willing to pay $12,000. And if you're the sucker who's got the 31st most expensive ticket, then you're the one who gets bumped off that flight. And I didn't really want to sort of be in that situation.
I feel like your travels gave you a window into the future of international travel. Tell me what your experience taught you about the future of international travel, business, and how we're going to connect the world again.
Well, it matters economically because tourism is a huge industry. There are countries where it is the biggest industry. And there's a lot of travel that isn't strictly holiday related. But if you think about, for example, the millions of students who travel to study in a different country each year, that is lost income to all of those countries where those students travel to. It keeps families apart. You know, I can honestly tell you that, you know, the tragic story of one of my own family members where I had a cousin who was dying far too young. It happened fairly quickly. And his brother lived in France and he did the same thing I did to get back. And he was in the hotel quarantine and his brother died on the final day, the 14th day of the hotel quarantine. And they wouldn't let him out to say goodbye. And there are lots of situations like that around the world. So it does matter that things can open up again. But because we have this very uneven vaccine rollout and we already live in an unequal world, that's colliding with the fact that these COVID control systems are different in every single country.
Right.
So, you know, you're essentially in a situation where none of these systems are standardized. Everyone does it in a slightly different way, so it's extremely annoying as a traveler. And everyone's at a slightly different part of the vaccine rollout. Everyone had a slightly different experience of COVID and what worked for them. So it's just going to be very, very slow opening back up again. And to get to the point of the mass tourism that we knew in 2019, like if we tried to do that now, it would be absolute hell or chaos. There is truly no way for that to happen in the next few months based on what I've just gone through over the past month. It is far too difficult for people. Mm. And so we are looking at these travel difficulties extending into 2022. That is my 100% belief.
Wow. This is, you know, this is concerning. Like, I guess we're all thinking, you know, we're going to be out seeing the world. But the truth is, just because we're getting vaccines doesn't mean the rest of the world is.
That's another reason why it's important to realize that the vaccine situation is a global game. So I think Joe Biden has made a smart political move to say that Americans will be vaccinated with American doses and money first. But it's also in America's interest to make sure that everyone in the world gets vaccinated and that they don't lose out in a diplomatic war to countries like China and Russia, who are certainly donating vaccines around the world. So it will be critical for your own personal vacation and for broader US interests for the US to get into that game of donating doses of vaccines.
And you know a lot about this, like vaccine brawl. What's the latest on that? You've written extensively on it.
Yeah. I think that the US really missed a trick by not being willing to come up with some strategic donations early on. I think that the Defense Production Act allows for a lot of ramping up of production capacity, and it could allow for the US to be exporting some doses now already, for example. Like the EU has sent roughly one dose to other countries for every dose that it has shared amongst its own members. It's the same with India. China hasn't worried so much about vaccinating at home yet, and it's quite happy to sort of send all of those doses abroad. And Russia, it's in a bit of a weird situation where Russians don't trust the Russian government, so they don't want the vaccine for that reason, which means they've got plenty to hand out to other countries.
Yeah.
But because the US was so focused on vaccinating Americans, it really lost out a lot of those sort of goodwill gestures and headlines, let's say.
I would also say vaccine diplomacy, right? Like if all of these, I mean, I've heard from people in, you know, the islands, the Caribbean islands so close to us that China is offering their vaccines to them, and it's allowing China to have this lasting imprint on the diplomacy mm-hmm. and the connections where they're choosing China over us and they're so close to us, like geographically. Yep.
And the US is making a very significant contribution to a UN project called COVAX, which is an attempt to reduce all of the risk among all countries when it comes to the vaccine. Even though COVAX is going to deliver millions, billions more vaccines than what China and Russia are going to do to countries around the world, because COVAX wasn't there at the beginning, it's missed out on all of that first impression goodwill, let's say. And so the US is going to pay a price for that, I think.
Do you think the WHO could kind of like create a standard process for countries in terms of accepting travelers? And is that within their purview to create kind of like this world organization, you know, mandate of like, okay, every traveler needs to have been tested in the past 6 days. If they haven't been tested, do they have vaccines? Like, is there going to be an international vaccine card? You know, I wonder if that's going to be... if that's the future and if it's even possible. I mean, I guess, I don't know.
Introducing health genius Tara Palmieri, and I'll tell you why, because the WHO has issued interim guidance on exactly that. They have come up with a set of standards and recommendations of how countries can introduce vaccine passports, essentially the certification system that will prove that you've had a vaccine and that you're safe to travel. So they are actually moving in that direction right now. It's not clear that many countries are going to listen to their advice, but they are trying to get ahead of that issue because there's clearly demand both in private companies and amongst all the governments and authorities that deal with people moving across borders. They want this to be more standardized, and there's certainly a lot of work to do in that regard.
Right. I mean, they do. That is an organization lacking some credibility right now. But, you know, keep on keeping on, right? Thanks so much for joining me, Ryan. When do you return? That is the real question.
May. Once you've got all the way through this process, you have to spend at least a month down under. So that's what I'm doing.
I'll be fully vaccinated by then, and I'll be ready to hug you and even give you a kiss on the cheek. So I can't wait for that.
I can't wait. I'm so glad to spend this time with you.
And that's our show. Almost. We've got one last treat for you.
Okay, here we go.
Take it away, Scott Bland.
Hello, Nerdcasters. Remember me, your old pal, Scott Bland, host of this very podcast? I'm on parental leave, so my colleagues have graciously taken over my show. But I'm here because I have some news for you. You ready? We're ending Nerdcast. In fact, this is the last show. You are at the end of the last Nerdcast podcast. But don't be sad. We at Politico are coming back with another podcast very soon, so stay subscribed. I'll be turning over the mic to the whole Politico newsroom. Different reporter each week who is going to take us behind the scenes on some very surprising stories about Washington, the kind of things that only our reporters know best. And don't worry, I'll be in the mix there too with all my fellow journalists, like Zach Montalaro.
Yeah.
Zach, you remember how Nerdcast started? What, like, way back in 2016?
I think it launched before the 2016 election. Something like that.
I'm trying to think. I mean, the thing that I remember most about the early Nerdcast is the insane clown music.
the circus music, yeah.
Got a lot of feedback. Yes. The haunted circus music, that's right. Yeah, got a lot of feedback about that. Boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
It was really scary.
It's, like, off-key. And we kept it for years, didn't it last until 2020?
Did it really last until 2020? It's been such a long year.
I think it did.
Zach.
Scott.
Lightning round. Describe Nerdcast. Mm. One word. Go.
Chaotic.
I would say fun. I've had a lot of fun doing this.
Do you have a favorite episode?
A few weeks ago, I was on a Zoom call with Dick Cheney.
Oh, now we're going to war here. Oh, look at that. Another war.
In Trump world.
What do Republicans believe?
Loyalty to him is an absolute and unyielding necessity.
Hey, Politicos.
And what does it mean to be a Republican?
I like to carry a golf ball.
How do they do that?
Your knuckles don't get stuck.
Yeah, I'm gripping the mail so I don't drop it.
Very impressive.
I just never want to lose
punctuated
anything.
Punctuated with
the highs.
Moments of exhilaration. But the tedium is real.
Hello?
Plenty of time. And you say, hello? Like, hey.
Hi, Nerdcasters.
We're almost out of time anyway.
I do have a favorite episode. It's the one it's the one where Annie and Jenny did such a great job cutting in Sammy doing his podcast.
I'm ready for my podcast.
Yeah, you're ready to record your podcast? What's the name of your podcast?
It's Wendy Dido.
So that was pretty cool. I think we're going to hold that one in the vault for a long time. Hello, listeners.
Hello, listeners.
Hello, listeners. Ooh, almost. Boom, 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 boom. Da 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 da. Zach Montalaro, thanks for joining this walk down memory lane.
Scott Bland, thanks for having me.
Okay, remember to stay subscribed and look out for what we are cooking up for you. Bye bye, nerds.
Our producer is Annie Reese. Our senior producer is Jenny Ament. And our executive producer is Irene Noguchi. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. And check out my stories every morning in Politico Playbook, your unofficial guide to official Washington. Thanks for listening.
I was like really struggling figuring out how to, okay, like, where's my Zoom? Where's the button for Zoom? Oh, yeah, there it is. Okay. And I've got my headphones. Oh, right. And I have to put the other headphones on under these headphones. And then I was like, put the plug in here. Nope. Other way around. Yeah. So got there eventually. Cool. Still recording.